Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Ag Innovation News Podcast, presented by the Agricultural Utilization Research Institute of Minnesota. I'm Dan Scogan, your host for the Ag Innovation News Podcast. Guests on this program shed light on innovations in value-added agriculture, highlight important voices and work that's being done throughout the Minnesota ag sector, and educate the public about resources and organizations that support Minnesota agriculture. Today, we want to welcome to the Ag Innovation News Podcast, Makil Rubino. Makil is a business development advisor and has extensive work in business and corporate development, fundraising, and deal-making at the intersection of biotechnology and clean technology. Makil Rubino, welcome to the Ag Innovation News Podcast.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
Let's start with your background. We always like to get a little more on our guests. So tell me a little bit about yourself and the work that you're involved with.
I have been active in the biofuel space for over 30 years. Started off in Europe, a lot of work in biodiesel across different lines of business, across different roles. And about 20 years ago, came over to this side of the pond and started working in the US, a lot of work on traditional ethanol in the early 2000s, mostly on the offtake trading. Got back involved in biodiesel in the US, what I would say were the pretty early days of biodiesel. And in about 2005, 2006, kind of exited what I would call the conventional biofuels business and got more active in advanced biofuels, newer technologies. Did a lot of work in cellulosic ethanol. And then I would say probably 8 years ago, got active through my background in fats, oils, and greases in the whole emerging renewable diesel and SAF space. And have worked throughout regions, roles, technologies, feedstock, products from, as I said, biodiesel, renewable diesel, SAF, algae, fats, oils, and greases, grains, waste-based feedstocks, have covered a lot of ground in the biofuel space.
And in those biofuel spaces, Makil, there's a lot of moving pieces, a lot of different ways to go. So was there something in particular that attracted you to those LCFS markets, the biofuels or the sustainable aviation fuel?
LCFS is a mechanism that is very effective and tied to a very clear goal of reducing the carbon intensity of the transportation sector. So I'm based in California, was involved in some of the early work on LCFS, and clearly like that approach in terms of being a technology-neutral, market-driven approach to decarbonize transportation. Advanced biofuels and sustainable aviation fuels clearly are some of the newest trends, and they're getting a lot of attention. As in all these things, you get bubbles, they burst, and then some people pick themselves up. And typically version number two, version number three is what works out. So I'm really looking forward to seeing the emergence of this whole space.
Eventually want to dig into renewable hydrogen. I want to talk a little bit about the SAF, of course, and even ethanol a little bit as we start to disrupt something that's more traditional now. But let's start with SAF. We've heard a lot about it the last few years, the SAF fuels. What kind of progress, in your opinion, have we made in developing a sustainable aviation fuel?
So, disclaimer, I have traditionally been a bit of a skeptic on SAF because I think the focus was misplaced. Jet fuel is the easiest fuel you can get out of a traditional petroleum feedstock, and by far the most challenging you can get out of a renewable feedstock. So I was always like, let's attack where we have a sweet spot in the slate of products and focus not on displacing one molecule or the other, but decarbonizing the entire sector. That said, the momentum is clear. The market has spoken, policy has spoken. SAF is on a trajectory to become a real thing. I would say at this point, most of the SAF currently is still made from traditional feedstock, fats, oils, and greases, and specifically your soybean oil in the US. Europe has taken a very literal approach to SAF, sustainable, so no crop-based feedstocks are allowed to generate SAF. So they're going more the route of the waste fats, oils, and greases, such as animal fats and used cooking oil. Those facilities have been set up to make renewable diesel and naphtha. You are starting to see the big players from Neste to Marathon, Valero through Diamond Green Diesel have made a lot of announcements that they are reconfiguring to increase the output of SAF, and that's going to clearly continue because the markets have spoken. The policy at this point is in place, both in the US, in Europe, not really yet, but it's coming. So I think that SAF is going to happen. And $1.25 to $1.75 tax credit is going to be driving this. It's going to take some time for the agencies to get this right, to put in place all the rulemakings and everything, but I don't have any doubt that it's going to happen. Now, obviously, that is not going to produce enough SAF to really make a material dent in jet fuel. We're going to need new sources of feedstocks. We're going to need new technologies. Ethanol to jet, so SAF from ethanol is in everyone's mouth. LanzaJet just opened their ethanol to jet facility in Georgia. There's a lot of development there, and I believe that while chemical engineer would tear their hair out looking at the chemistry of ethanol to jet, the economics are going to work.
And if I'm tracking right, McKeel, what I hear you saying is policy is being developed, the interest is there, and the money is going to follow.
I agree. Yes, that's exactly it.
In the United States right now, what are we using for feedstock? What's typical for SAF?
There is very little SAF actually in the market, to be clear. This is coming. Now, EPA still has to finalize its rulemaking on the SAF tax credit. So there's been some uncertainty with the GREET model and things like that. But the larger renewable diesel refineries from Marathon to Neste abroad that imports in the US, to Valero and Diamond Green Diesel, they're reconfiguring. Their feedstocks are animal fats, used cooking oil. And the question is if soybean oil will be allowed as a feedstock for SAF. In Europe, absolutely no, we know that. In the US, I do believe that after it all shakes out with the rulemakings, SAF from soybean oil, SAF from vegetable oils will make it. Probably you'll have to have a good low carbon intensity pathway, depend on ag practices and things like that. But I can't imagine a scenario where soybean oil is completely excluded from benefiting from this new market. So right now, yellow grease, animal fats, used cooking oil, other types of waste oils and fats, I think in the future there will also be some vegetable oil that currently goes to make biodiesel. It's the same feedstock that is used to make renewable diesel or biodiesel. So currently that's it. But down the road, there's a lot of development from ethanol to municipal solid waste. I see a lot of biomass to SAF projects, but those are in the 5 to 10 year horizon.
I'm guessing if we're going to be talking about value-added agriculture, some of our producers that want to be involved in this process are going to have to change how they think about producing the feedstock, how far they're going to have to transport the feedstock, and how far they're going to have to transport the end product to the end user. There's a lot of different pieces in this equation.
I agree, and I think a lot of this thought process is happening. We're talking SAF, but say on the ethanol side, in terms of agricultural practices, no-tilling, in terms of fertilizer use, let's say this has been spurred in the ethanol sector before because of wanting to reduce the carbon intensity of corn ethanol to access the higher values in the California market. But some of these same thoughts, both in terms of the ag practices, in terms of the logistics and the supply chains, the production facilities and the offtake. Now, the good news with how things are evolving and shaping up is that these opportunities have typically relied on the California market. And so moving the product into California to take advantage of the LCFS, that's no longer going to be the case. With the tax credit, I think for SAF, these will be go into local markets. I see there's a lot of work in Minneapolis to enable a hub, a SAF hub at the refinery that feeds, at the terminal that feeds the airport there. So SAF will be, in terms of use, much more distributed than renewable diesel or some of the other advanced biofuels that we're relying on California.
I want to come back and talk about renewable hydrogen, maybe the role that ethanol is playing in some of this new technology. But I want to remind our listeners that you're listening to the Ag Innovation News podcast, and we're visiting today with Michiel Rabino. He is a business development advisor and has extensive work in business and corporate development, fundraising, deal making, and all at the intersection of biotechnology and clean technology. Michiel, let's turn the page here to renewable hydrogen. What might its role be, and how critical is it to the equation as we start to talk about some of these new biofuels?
I mean, obviously, there's so much talk about renewable hydrogen and the role hydrogen plays in the energy transition. I am a believer that before we can talk about the role that hydrogen plays in the energy transition, we have to deal with the fact that the current supply of hydrogen is very carbon intensive. So the first thing is to displace hydrogen made from fossil fuels in its existing applications, from the production of ammonia, to steel making, etc., etc. So before we even talk about hydrogen as a transportation fuel, I think we have to fix hydrogen as a problem. And the use of hydrogen in these incumbent applications is pretty massive. I saw some studies saying if we wanted to produce enough renewable hydrogen to displace all the hydrogen in these applications, the amount of wind power in the US would not be sufficient. So I would stick to these applications for hydrogen. Distributing hydrogen for vehicle use is a holy grail that people have been after, and I'm in California, and they throw subsidies at that like it's about to happen. I'm not a believer that that's the right path. I think hydrogen is a very important molecule to be used where it's needed in processing, refineries. SAF production needs hydrogen, so that's perfect. That's a perfect use for hydrogen and the other existing uses. So it plays a role as an intermediate. It plays a role as an input to the manufacturing of fuels. The way I always describe it is today you have battery powered vehicles. So you can take your renewable electricity and put it in a vehicle and power the vehicle. Another option is to take that renewable electricity, make hydrogen out of it, take the hydrogen, distribute it at pressure in pressurized vessels, put it in a pressurized tank in a car, and turn it back to electricity to make power. So I'd rather just put the electricity. You know, hydrogen, as I said, as an input to refineries, to displacing the existing applications of ammonia production. The other thing is hydrogen, when we talk about renewable hydrogen, all we have really is electrolyzer hydrogen, splitting water with electricity. That is very, very electricity intensive. And to be renewable, it all has to use renewable electricity. And it's not like renewable electricity is that abundant beyond its current uses in renewable portfolio standards that the different states have.
Michiel, I appreciate that you openly admit your skepticism and at the same time share some valuable information on where the industry is at and where they're probably going. So when you think about barriers around advancing SAF or renewable hydrogen, you're not alone in your skepticism, I'm guessing. So what are some of the concerns that you're hearing from the industry?
When it comes to SAF, I think we have our first generation pretty lined up. The economics are there, the policy is there, that first generation technology is there, and the money is coming, both project finance, corporate money. In California, both Marathon and Phillips were going to shut their refineries in the Bay Area unless they were able to do something in that energy transition space. So these large players, the money and project finance money is available. Future, this will require technology development. It will require, as a result, it will require policy stability. That typically is what has always ended up hurting the long-term prospects of these opportunities when the technology, the policy, regulatory stability isn't there. So people that are now looking at new feedstocks, new technology, biomass to SAF, methanol to SAF, ethanol to SAF, municipal solid waste to SAF, these require technology development, pilot plants, first commercial plants, loan guarantees, on the back end, the policy on the market. So these things will need to be stable. At least in the US, you could assume the money will be there. So that's the challenges facing the SAF. The hydrogen, again, if we stick to the current hydrogen uses, I think we'll slowly displace fossil-based hydrogen as renewable hydrogen becomes more available. And the vehicle side of hydrogen would require massive investments in the whole infrastructure, tanks and the vehicles themselves. And I just don't see that there being enough of a driver for that. As a little side, I have worked and I'm a big fan of technology to convert ethanol to hydrogen. I do believe that there are niche opportunities. And, you know, I was looking at it in the context of ethanol producers wanting to diversify from just being reliant on the ethanol market and the animal feed market. And so looking for new markets applications, ethanol to hydrogen done locally, captive, combined with a renewable diesel or SAF project in kind of these Midwest clusters, is, I think, something that makes a lot of sense. And then that hydrogen can be used to locally make fertilizer, ammonia, urea, a hub to make SAF using local feedstocks. So these very distributed bioeconomy opportunities that rely on the local resources.
I want to come back to ethanol in a little bit, but I just have a question about measuring carbon intensity in SAF. I've heard there's kind of a difference of opinion on whether or not we're getting a good measurement there. Is that something you're dealing with?
I've been exposed to some of this. Obviously, there are some aspects of the law that make the carbon intensity really important to what the value of the product is. So the methodology has been debated and fought over, but I think the latest indications from EPA that they will use an updated GREET model, they should be issuing the parameters pretty shortly. And so we will see that what that implies in terms of feedstocks that will qualify. You have to be at least 50% reduction to get the $125 a gallon tax credit on SAF. And on hydrogen, there are tiers based on carbon intensity. So this will matter. Now, that all of that said, I have very little doubt that ethanol to jet will be allowed. Obviously, we're going to be having to talk about ethanol facilities that have made certain investments to reduce the carbon intensity from feedstock side, carbon capture, and other options they have. But I can't see how politically in the US you will exclude an interest group, let's say a set of stakeholders of that importance, from benefiting from this law.
I want to stay with ethanol here for just a second and talk about those producers who drive the feedstock for the ethanol companies, McKeel, because it appears to me that with renewable hydrogen and SAF, we are working on something that has the potential to be disruptive to what we now consider traditional. And ethanol has over the years proven itself to be more traditional. And it's probably making ethanol producers a little nervous when we're talking about new and exciting things. So what's ethanol's role going to be as we move forward with renewable hydrogen or with SAF?
This is the big opportunity for ethanol producers. You're right. They are typically very conservative, very tied to the farming heritage, and that comes with some natural skepticism for what's new and reluctance to jump on the first train. A conservative group of folks. But this is really the great opportunity. So ethanol can be a feedstock for SAF, and the SAF market is going to be feedstock limited. So it needs new feedstocks. The question is, ethanol has to be sufficiently low carbon to qualify for these SAF provisions. I see a lot of, I mean, recently POET joined the Summit Carbon Pipeline, indicating their commitment to carbon capture. We're going to see more of that. So for sure, I see it as a great opportunity for SNR producers. Some will have the capital to capitalize on it. Others might not. And so there will be a normal shakeout, as always, when these disruptions come. I think SNR to hydrogen is an interesting opportunity. And to think about an SNR biorefinery, taking in grain, making some animal feed, taking some ethanol, and then a lot of CO2 that goes up. Now that CO2, people talk carbon capture. But if you took the ethanol and made hydrogen, and you have a very pure stream of CO2, you know, CO2 and hydrogen is the way ammonia and fertilizers are made, and air to get the nitrogen. So there you have a recipe for expanding your product slate, participating in a market like fertilizer that can be local, right? Luca knows this well. Most of the fertilizer coming in for Minnesota comes through the Gulf Coast from methane from the Caribbean or other markets. For sure, I think this could be a good opportunity.
When we talk about disruption, how about the oil companies and the legacy supply of jet fuel currently? Are they going to have a role here as we move into new technologies?
Yeah, I do think that in the last 5-10 years, you've seen a transition. You know, the transition from biodiesel to renewable diesel is a transition where the oil companies were opposing it to the oil companies are embracing it. That's why you go from biodiesel to renewable diesel. Biodiesel is made in small plants, not tied to refineries. Renewable diesel, it's integrated into their refinery concept. So I do see, with the kind of newest trends, oil companies see this as an opportunity. They see the writing on the wall. Obviously, these assertions that fossil fuels are going away by 2035 are obviously exaggerated and they're just political stunts. But they imply, they signify a trend. And I think most companies have understood that. And you're starting to see Valero, Marathon, even Exxon, some of the traditional companies starting to embrace this. So they are going to be part of both renewable diesel, SAF. And I would assume that in many cases, the ethanol producers, say for ethanol to jet, they're going to sell ethanol to the refinery that then will convert it to SAF and blend it with fossil-based jet fuel for distribution. So I think this is already happening.
And I know when we talk about setting up these markets and getting incentives into the marketplace, we hear a lot of the chatter coming from the West Coast. What are other states doing and what roles are they taking in advancing these fuels? Do you see much else going on other than California?
As I said before, I think the reliance on the West Coast market is dwindling and it's soon going to be a thing of the past. SAF tax credit, that's a federal program. The California carbon credits have been going down in value because they are well supplied, those LCFS markets. I don't see that SAF projects have to rely on the West Coast markets. With the tax credit, with the efficiency in that distribution, I do anticipate that Minneapolis is looking at having their Flint Hill refinery, the one close by that serves through one of the pipelines, the airport, to have their a SAF hub. And the pipeline operator, I can't remember the name, is involved. So I see the reliance on the West Coast markets going away. There are opportunities to, if it's the right SAF, to sell into Europe, because the Europe SAF markets are going to be much more feedstock limited. And so the value of SAF is going to be higher in Europe. And there could be opportunities for export to Europe. That could be an interesting trend to emerge. One comment on earlier question about oil companies and their involvement is, I think a trend that has happened in the last few years is traditionally oil companies and the renewable space, which was kind of centered and radicated, established within the ag community, they were at loggerheads. They were fighting each other for market share. Oil companies didn't want this. renewable ag wanted to enter into their turf. I think that's a thing of the past. I think now they both understand that the threat is electrification. And so they have come together as, hey, we're protecting liquid fuels, whether it's liquid from fossil or liquid from renewables. We have to work together to protect that market share from being electrified. The enemy, so to say, even though I think always there's an all of the above, there's a role for electrification. The enemy is electrification of transportation.
We're going to bring this conversation to a close today, but I do want to have you gaze into your crystal ball for a moment and maybe look 5 to 10 years down the road. What are you seeing as some major factors that are going to influence this new innovation and maybe drive it toward a more traditional use?
I think the trends that are in place will continue. Lower carbon intensity, more sustainability, desire to continue the energy transition, and also the desire to have more resilient supply chains. And by more resilient, you know, back then people talked about energy security as a national security, not relying on foreign imports. I think now it's more about having a really resilient supply chain. And so the importance of distributed production, of really enabling those clusters. So these trends are in place, in addition with, I think, technology trends. Q3 of 2023 in California, about 70% of the diesel market had been this fossil fuel diesel had been displaced by renewable diesel. If you think a bit about it, that's amazing. And that's in a few years. 70% of the renewal of the diesel market in California is now renewable diesel. If you told an oil executive this 10 years ago, you would have been laughed out of the room. I think these trends are in place, will continue. I wouldn't be surprised if in 10 years, 30, 40% of all jet fuel is SAF. I know the targets are high, but you know, those targets are ambitious for a reason. So only good times ahead. And electrification should be supported because that it does have a role.
If somebody is listening today that needs more information, either on these projects, on the research, or on your work, is there a good place to go for that source of information?
I'm happy to be in touch. And in terms of sources of information, I always find useful to go and to the EPA website and the CARB website and the website for the Renewable Energy Directive in Europe and read their updates. Both CARB and EPA provide good updates of where the markets are. USDA has some really good updates in terms of some of these policies and how they will trickle down and be implemented. But then obviously I'm happy to advise in this sector.
McKeel Rubino, I want to thank you for your time today. It was fun for me chatting with you, and I think it's very interesting where we're headed with some of these biofuels and some of this new technology. So thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Dan. Really appreciate you having me on the podcast.
We've been visiting with McKeel Rubino, the business developer advisor, and he has extensive work, as you have heard through this conversation, in business and corporate development, fundraising, and deal making at the intersection of biotechnology and clean technology. Again, we want to thank him for joining us today. And we want to thank you, too, for joining us and listening to the Ag Innovation News podcast, presented by the Agricultural Utilization Research Institute of Minnesota. I want to thank my podcast crew, Lisa Martinez, AURI Communications Manager and editor of this production. To learn more about AURI, go to auri.org.